This is the Comics Alternative, episode 211, Halloween Comics 2016. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Comics Alternative. I'm Derek.
And I'm Andy, and we're two guys with PhDs talking about comics.
And it is the Wednesday before Halloween, so this week Andy and I are going to talk about a variety of comics that are specifically published for this year's Halloween or have horror themes in some form or another. But before we get into that discussion, we want to let all of you know that this episode of the Comics Alternative is brought to you by the great folks at Discount Comic Book Service. Go to their website, dcbservice.com, for all of your comics pre-ordering needs. There, you're going to find all DC, Marvel, Image, and Dark Horse titles at 40% off of the cover price if you pre-order. For all of the other publishers, you'll find that those discounts are 20 to 35% off of the cover price. And every single month, you're going to find some wonderful, unbelievable specials. Sometimes those specials will be as much as 45% off cover price, sometimes 50% off cover. But you know, many times you can find discounts that go higher than that.
That's right. This month, as in every month, they have loads of bundles that you can take advantage of. Many, in fact, multiple bundles from both DC and Marvel, including bundles for all of the current Young Animals titles from DC, as well as DC's seven new Vertigo comics. So both of those bundles are 50% off, so you can check those out.
That's right. Great discounts every single month at Discount Comic Book Service. You have to go to their website to find out how many they have for the month of October. That's dcbservice.com. Go there for all your comics pre-ordering needs. And after you do get your comics there, please be sure to send them an email and tell them that the two guys with PhDs sent you.
That's right.
Well, Andy, before we get into our Halloween 2016 episode, report back on what you experienced the other week at Crossroads Columbus.
Yeah, so this year was the second year that Columbus, Ohio has hosted the Cartoons Crossroad Columbus Festival, but this is the first year that they had a academic conference or symposium as a component, and that was hosted by Ohio State and the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum, and led by Jared Gardner. Mm-hmm. And so that was on last week, I guess, week before last. I can't remember. I can't keep track of time anymore. Thursday and Friday, and then Friday, Saturday, and Sunday was the Cartoon Crossroads Columbus Festival. There was an expo at the downtown library. There were events at the Art Museum and Columbus College of Art and Design and several other locations. So the whole city kind of came out for this festival. And so during the academic component, I got to hang out with a bunch of people that I only get to see, I guess, at conferences. So Brandon Costello and Brian Kremens, Dan Yazbek, and several other academics whose work we all like. Mm-hmm. Got to hang out with Matt Smith and Randy Duncan, who've been on the show.
Oh, cool. You got to meet those guys.
Yeah, I've met them before, but this is the first time seeing them since I guess they've been on the show. Again, a couple of really nice guys. And then a bunch of other people I'm probably forgetting. And then as far as the events were concerned, there were really great events that involved Craig Fisher interviewing Seth, which he did a great job at. And then there was a conversation a couple days later between Seth and Ben Catcher.
Wow.
Because both Palookaville and now I'm drawing a blank on Ben Cantor, Novelties.
Oh, Julius Nipple Stories.
No. The something Novelties.
Oh yeah, those are Julius Nipples
Stories. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But anyway,
the reprint that's coming out from, or that just came out from Drawn and Quarterly.
Yeah. And that those were both 25 years old this year. So they had Tom Spurgeon, who's one of the organizers of the conference, talked to them, and Ben Catcher says hi to you.
Oh, great.
and then let's see what else. Got to see Charles Burns do a kind of career retrospective talk. And then, you know, got to meet and hang out with a bunch of people and talk to a bunch of people. You know, got to thank Nate Powell for being on the show with us, and talked to Durf Bachter for a little bit. Met Sergio Aragonés, which was a big life achievement event.
Part of your bucket list?
Yeah. And in fact, I had him sign an issue of the Star Reach series Quack. I don't know if you remember that from the 70s. They're kind of adult version of Funny Animals. And Sergio had written a story in there that Steve Lealoa had drawn. And when I pulled that out for Sergio, he was really, he hadn't seen one of those in a while. So that was kind of fun. And then I had nice conversations with, Brandon Graham. It was fun to get to meet. And he was hanging out with Robin McConnell from the Ink Studs podcast and Ryan Sands from Youth in Decline. So, lots of people, probably forgetting a lot of other people too, but, it was a really great show. And I think that, that Columbus, and especially Tom Spurgeon and Jeff Smith, who kind of run the whole thing, are doing a great job with that. That event. Oh, I shouldn't leave out that I got to actually spend a lot of time with Dean Mullaney over the weekend, because I got there early on Wednesday to do some research in the Billy Ireland Library, and he was already there, of course. And I asked him what he's working on, and he had like 7 projects going all at once for the Library of American Comics. And then when he was leaving on Saturday, he just pulled me over and said, take whatever you want from his display of books.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So anyway, so it was fun to talk to him, and we talked a lot for a long time for a lot of the weekend, especially talking about kind of, you know, 80s comics and the topic of the conference was cannon fodder and kind of challenging the narratives and histories and canonization of certain works, what should be there that's not being talked about, mm-hmm. and so on. And so, that, you know, that was right up Dean's alley. So I had a fun time just chatting with him about his days at Eclipse, and him telling me stories about how, you know, some of the stuff that they did there came about.
Well, I know that, you know, some of this stuff you were letting me know as it was happening because you were texting me every now and again during the event. So that was fun. So now you mentioned that Craig Fisher was interviewing Seth. Was this part of what you had texted me, that image of Seth silhouette?
No, the Seth silhouette was from the Ben Catcher and Seth event. So Seth had for that, he had his own slideshow, but the way that he was positioned on the stage, the projector was projecting kind of onto him so that the images of his books were on the screen behind him, but he was also being, he was also in profile, basically shadow on the screen. And since Seth's, his self-portrait that he uses in all his works is so distinctive, mm-hmm. and that he, you know, and his own kind of appearance is easily recognizable with the hat and the glasses and the suit and so on. I just thought it was really funny that you could kind of see the shadow of Seth on the on the screen behind him, and it looked more like his caricature.
Yeah, it's like became part of the show, it seemed, from the image you sent me. Maybe inadvertently.
Yeah. Yeah, and I got a chance while I was there, too, to pick up the documentary Seth's Dominion. And so I watched that when I got home, too.
Okay, so it was just the movie, not the book, the movie that's going to be in the book that's coming out.
No, it was both. It was the book and the movie.
Okay, so the book was available there. That's cool.
Yeah,
it's a great film, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. And I really enjoyed getting a chance to very briefly talk to Seth a couple times. So, and he drew a nice little Wimbledon green in my copy of Wimbledon Green.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I'm envious. I want to go there next year if I'm able.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope this keeps going. I hope it keeps getting bigger and bigger, and that, I got to talk a lot to Tom Spurgeon while there, and, they do a great job. It's an enormous amount of work. And so, if they need podcasters that are trained in or experienced, I guess, in interviewing comics creators, then, we can always throw our hats in the ring if they're interested.
Oh, that'd be cool.
I'm leaving out a lot of people that I talked to. I also forgot to mention too that ended up flying on the plane back to Charlotte with Dustin Harbin, who I ended up spending a lot of time with. He turned out to be an interesting, I don't want to say bad influence, but an interesting influence on the other academics that were there. Because every night somebody would say, or the next morning someone would say, I was up till 2 a.m. talking to Dustin Harbin at the bar. So, but he's a good guy.
Yeah, it sounds great. Yeah. It sounds like, the CXC is in some ways kind of like what I experienced at SPX, mm-hmm. except SPX is only 2 days and, there's not the academic emphasis. Also, you got to go to panels. I didn't go to any panels at SPX. I had wanted to and had planned to go to a couple, but it was whenever I was about to go to a panel, I thought, okay, that's about 2 hours less or an hour and a half or 2 hours less time, including standing in line, that right. I'm not on the floor discovering new stuff and possibly talking with people for the podcast. So I just forewent the panels.
Yeah. That was one of the nice things about this. And if CXC ends up having more success, it's going to end up getting bigger and this won't be an issue, but, this won't be a benefit of it, but it's contained enough that I felt like I wasn't missing anything if I went to a panel, mm-hmm. Like I had probably, walked through the floor multiple times, in the 2 days that I was at the expo itself, and I didn't have to stand in line for anybody. I didn't have to stand in line for Nate Powell. Or Sergio or Stan Sakai. The only lines they really ever had were when Jeff Smith would do a scheduled signing, because he wasn't there all the time. And then then Raina Telgemeier was there. I didn't even get close to her though, because that was a whole, they had to, have that in a whole separate area of the library. And you had to but you had to get a ticket in advance to get in line to get something signed from her.
Wow.
But she's a rock star.
Yeah. She's like her own industry.
Mm hmm.
Well, it sounds like you had a good time. Had a good time at the event, and maybe I can join you next year if you go.
Yeah,
we can get a room together.
Yeah, sure, and yeah, that'd be great. And some people also shared with me some stuff that's coming out that I was sworn to secrecy about not being able to talk about. But I think there's going to be some things we're going to definitely want to do. Some interviews on coming up.
Cool. You can tell me off the air.
Jekyll and Hyde.
Jekyll and Hyde.
Jekyll and Hyde.
Jekyll and Hyde.
personality splits in two. Jekyll and Hyde, Jekyll and Hyde.
Well, on the air this week, you and I are going to be discussing this year's batch of Halloween comics, and there are a couple new things than we've done in the past. I guess first and foremost, over the past 3 years, I think we started this in 2013, the person who was doing the Halloween show with me was Gene. So this is the first time you and I are doing a special Comics Alternative Halloween episode. So that's different from the previous years. Another thing that's different is that this year we decided to look not only at comics that were specifically conceived for Halloween 2016, but to look at some other new releases that have something to do with horror or ghost or vampires or the undead in some form or another. So there are a couple of things that you and I are going to discuss that aren't necessarily Halloween comics, but they're coming out around the couple of weeks near Halloween that have a ghost or vampire theme to them in some way. So we're considering them, for all practical purposes, Halloween comics for this year.
Sure, and I think that the fact that these publishers timed the release of these comics to be right around Halloween anyway indicates that they were planning that.
Exactly. Well, there are a lot of titles for us to discuss, so let's go ahead and jump into things. Now, there are a lot of titles, and the ones that we're going to be discussing in some way or another, sometimes we may just touch lightly on these titles, sometimes we may take a deeper dive, are going to be The Simpsons Treehouse of Horror number 22, SpongeBob Comics number 61, Adventure Time Spooktacular 2016, Giant Halloween Hex, Betty Boop number 1, Spell on Wheels number 1, The Lost Boys number 1, American Vampire Anthology number 2, The Double Life of Miranda Turner volume 1, and Nix Comics Quarterly number 9. So, I mean, that's a lot of stuff. And what we decided to do, dear listener, is to break it down into chunks, into kind of groupings. And we thought that the first grouping to begin our discussion for this week would be those series of comics that were specifically devoted to Halloween this year that are made up of a variety of different stories. So these would be The Simpsons Treehouse of Horror number 22 from Bongo, SpongeBob 61 from United Plankton Pictures, Adventure Time Spooktacular 2016, which is a Kaboom comic, and then from IDW, Giant Halloween Hex, which is a Disney title that includes three different stories. And we don't have to talk about these four titles in the order that I mentioned them, but we could just jump in and maybe discuss them as a whole and dig into specifics as we go along.
Okay.
I have to say, I like the format of these comics, and in particular, something like a SpongeBob or a Simpsons Treehouse or Adventure Time, because they've been doing this for a long time, holiday-oriented collections. And, you know, sometimes the stories are longer, sometimes they're shorter, but they're always fun, and they're all age. Although I do think that Adventure Time Spooktacular tends to trend younger, which is understandable. But there's something that I think these are the titles that could be enjoyed by young readers, and in fact, sometimes very young readers, but even, you know, older, matured, grizzled readers like the two of us.
Okay.
At least I enjoy them. I don't know. Did you like them?
Well, I have to say this. I've watched Adventure Time, but the Adventure Time Spooktacular focuses almost entirely on one of the penguins, Gunter.
Mm-hmm.
Almost every story is about him, and or has him as a kind of central figure in it, and that. Well, I've watched Adventure Time. That was a character I wasn't familiar with. And then I realized in looking at and reading the SpongeBob comic that while I have watched SpongeBob, I guess I have so little familiarity with that. Mm-hmm. That comic was somewhat lost on me. With the Simpsons Treehouse of Horror, that comic book seemed to be like, I couldn't imagine someone coming to the Simpsons the way, say, I was coming to Adventure Time. I would think that Treehouse of Horror book to be really, really difficult. Because that one really, really has a lot of its jokes rely on knowledge of Simpsons history, basically. And then the Disney Halloween Hex is a book that is made up largely, I think entirely of reprints, right?
Right.
Many of which are from the Italian Disney comics, which was where many of the new Disney stories were done for a while when there wasn't a Disney comic published in the United States with new stuff in it.
Right. Now, the first story in the Giant Halloween Hex from Disney, which is The Great Rock of Power Plus, that was originally an Italian story that was published in 1995. But that second one, though, and it's much shorter, Perilous Portrait is from a Dutch issue of Donald
right.
Duck.
Right.
And then the third one, which is it's short as well, is from Walt Disney's Comics and Stories, number 291, U.S., from 1964.
Yeah.
But by far the longest story in that collection, right, was that Italian Topolino 2043, which appeared in 1995. Mm-hmm. So,
both of those first two stories then are translated into English for the first time.
Right.
Exactly. In this volume. Yeah.
Yeah. So, they're interesting for that reason alone, right? So, you know, big Disney fans, Uncle Scrooge fans especially, who can't read Italian or Dutch are going to love this because they get to see these stories for the first time. I enjoyed this. I like Uncle Scrooge. I have to say I haven't really had a lot of experience with – is it Magica Dispel or Magica Dispel?
I would say Magica Dispel.
That's what I thought. I haven't had – I mean, I've read some stuff with her in the past, but I don't know a lot about her. But you don't need to know the backstory of Magica Dispel and her relationship with Uncle Scrooge in order to really enjoy this. And in fact, I think the editor of this issue anticipates this because in the table of contents – or on the page with the table, then you get a little message from Magica where she basically presents the context of her relationship with Uncle Scrooge and wanting to get his, you know, the number one dime that he cherishes greatly. And that is important because that's what that first story, which makes up the vast majority of this issue, The Great Rock of Power Plus, that fact is hinged on the story is hinged on that number one dime.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although, interestingly enough, the number one dime doesn't come into play except at the very beginning and then at the very end of this story. Everything that goes on in between, you could not mention the dime at all, and I don't think you would miss anything that goes on. It's fun enough. I enjoyed it. I won't say that the Disney Giant Hollywood Hex was my favorite of this grouping of comics, but it was good. It had been a long time since I had read a Disney comic. It reminded me of being a kid and, you know, reading some of the comics, definitely watching the cartoons. I liked that. Now, I was interested to hear your take on SpongeBob because you had mentioned not really having a lot of experience with SpongeBob and feeling a little lost. Of this first bunch that we're talking about, you know, the Simpsons, Treehouse of Horror, SpongeBob, Adventure Time, and then the Disney, SpongeBob was the one of these four that I liked the most. And I think largely because I really enjoy SpongeBob SquarePants, the cartoon. But also, I've read a number of other SpongeBob comics in the past, and I really do enjoy them. And I think they're different from the episodic kind of stories that we get, let's say, in The Simpsons or, you know, for this show, The Simpsons Treehouse of Horror. And having a couple of kids who grew up watching SpongeBob, where it was almost always on in the house, my wife really enjoys SpongeBob as well. I enjoy SpongeBob. So we've spent in the royal household a lot of time watching SpongeBob. This stuff is very familiar to me. So I guess my response is going to be different from yours, basically for that reason alone.
Yeah, one of the things I do admire about the SpongeBob comics, though, and you know, and we've had editor Chris Duffy, on the show before, is I really like the talent he puts together for these issues, some of whom you know are in a lot of the comics, like James Kochalka, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the main story, the Krusty Curse, or the luck of Mr. Patrick Starr, is written and drawn by Vince DePorter, and that's again the main story in that issue. And then there's shorter pieces, and I actually kind of like the shorter pieces better. The House on Jellyfish Fields,
mm-hmm,
by Graham Annibal, and I like that one because it is, I think it's entirely silent.
Right.
Yeah. And in really tiny panels. So there's often, you know, 20 panels per page in some of these pages, but, that is a really effective and well done story. And then, James Kochalka Sponge Funnies and then, Flotsam Fables, Legends of the Deep by Karen Snyder and Vanessa Davis, another one page story. So I did like the shorter pieces. In fact, I think a little better, mainly because the creators on those are doing something interesting and kind of experimental, I guess, with their subject matter.
Right.
Whereas the main story, which is fine, is a pretty straightforward comic story.
It is, and you mentioned Chris Duffy bringing different talent together. This mm-hmm. is often what you find in a SpongeBob comic.
Right.
Maybe a main story or a more traditional, almost like gag story that you would expect mm-hmm. from SpongeBob. And then other stories that aren't, I guess, traditionally humor stories or are presented in different ways. And I'm with you on Graham Annibal's The House on Jellyfish Field, and the way that the story is told silently and in these small panels, that for me is, I guess, the highlight of this issue, although I really did like the other one that you mentioned, Flotsam mm-hmm. Fables, Legends of the Deep, just because I like the art of Vanessa Davis.
Right.
And that was very different as well. But, you know, looking at this one that starts with, you know, this more traditional, longer story, the Krusty Curse, it occurs to me that of these four that we're discussing now, they're structured fairly similarly, right? The Simpsons Treehouse of Horror starts off with the first story, which is the longest of the batch, Ghost Bashers, mm-hmm. and then the other stories that follow are shorter in nature. Same thing with the one that we were discussing a second ago, Disney's Giant Halloween Hex. There's that long story that was originally published in Italian, and then the others are significantly shorter. And I think something similar is there with Adventure Time Spooktacular 2016. I just like SpongeBob. I think they're fun stories. Now, I like The Simpsons as well. But I guess the thing that I appreciate more about SpongeBob, it's that my experience with SpongeBob comics over Simpsons comics, and I have more experience with SpongeBob than Simpsons comics, mm-hmm. is that there seems to be more what you could call experimentation, variation with the story types and tone
right.
in SpongeBob than you get in Treehouse. Although, you know, I like The Simpsons as a whole. And comics as well. But reading Treehouse of Horror number 22, it's very similar to watching an episode of The Simpsons, Treehouse of Horror. So if you like The Simpsons television cartoon, then of course you're going to like the Treehouse of Horror, just like you're going to like The Simpsons comics, because they're very similar in nature. With Ghost Bashers, this is a parodic take on Ghostbusters. And now you had mentioned that readers of The Simpsons Treehouse of Horror are probably going to have to know quite a bit about The Simpsons property, the TV show, I guess, in order to get a fuller understanding of what's going on in this comic. Also, there's the assumption, kind of like on the television show, that a knowledge of just general pop culture, common knowledge stuff is going to come into play, that you need to know that. So, you know, obviously references to the Ghostbuster movies, and both movies, right? You know, the original and the most recent one that I didn't see with the all-female cast. In fact, they make fun of that. They make reference to that at one point. But there are other references that are thrown in there, you know, Mary Poppins, things of that sort. And again, I like this well enough, but it's just very much like a Simpsons cartoon. So, you know, I have no problem with it being a comic book version of the TV show. But the thing I appreciate more about SpongeBob is it's a little different than the TV series.
Yeah. I think Chris Duffy puts together really good talent for the SpongeBob comic. Not to say that the talent isn't there isn't talent involved in the Treehouse of Horror comic. But, you know, in looking at that Ghost Bashers story, one of the plot points is that all these dead characters from The Simpsons come back to life.
Right.
Or come back as ghosts, I should say. And so, one of the first ones being Frank Grimes from the one really great episode where Homer ends up driving Frank Grimes to his grave. And then later Sherry Bobbins, who's the Mary Poppins parody. And then even more and more, some just for one shot, including one, probably my favorite, and this is just a one-panel throwaway, where the Ghost Bashers are beating the heck out of Maude Flanders' ghost while Rod, Todd, and Ned are watching. That, to me, was like where this got into fun, sick territory.
Yeah.
But, you know, you mentioned that they do reference the female Ghostbusters. They do, but it's kind of just thrown away within a couple panels.
Right.
In a way that I thought could have been done more effectively, because all it seems to say is, hey, here's a reference to the female Ghostbusters, bye, and then it's gone. And I think that was one of my issues with a lot of the stuff in here, is that they would make a reference to something that it felt like it was being made for the sake of making a reference rather than actually making a joke about it.
Right. Yeah. So. But, you know, that's like the television show sometimes. I mean, sometimes they'll bring in references and utilize it more effectively, and other times maybe not so much. Now, you're right. Mm-hmm. The reference to the female Ghostbusters, or the most recent Ghostbuster film, this is right after the guys get there. And these Ghostbusters, it's Homer, Lenny. What's Lenny's friend?
Carl.
Carl, and then Dr. Fink. So it's the four of those guys, and after their first job, the female Ghostbusters come in, and we have I'm blanking on Homer's wife.
Marge.
I was about to say Maude, but Marge. Marge says, the female Ghostbusters are here to help. But then they kind of dismiss them, where Homer says, you know, well, we got, you know, all the same dealies, plus we're kind of doing it first. And then Marge says, but we're all women. And then Homer says, seems kind of pointless and redundant, really. And then the women are walking off, Marge says, see, I told you, girls, he just wouldn't get it. And I haven't seen – have you seen the most recent Ghostbusters?
No. Okay.
See – I didn't see it, but my – and it could be a great movie for all I know. So I'm not making any judgment calls whatsoever. I'm just saying, when I heard that they were making a new Ghostbusters with an all-female Ghostbuster cast instead of male, my first thought without even thinking much about it, was what Homer is saying here seems kind of pointless and redundant, really. Of course, I have a thing about remakes as it is when it comes to Hollywood, but and so that's where I thought the joke was going there. So, see, I thought that they tended to use quite well for comedic effects the most recent film. And so the fact that the women Ghostbusters were only on for three panels was the point.
Yeah, I get that, but yeah. I don't know. I felt like there could have been done more with that. I actually kind of felt like that was a bit dismissive of that. You know, the female Ghostbusters and what that movie was actually accomplishing. But anyway, I don't, you know, I felt like a lot of the stuff in the Simpsons book were just kind of these quick references, a lot of which didn't really land. That may be the case of the Simpsons nowadays anyway. Mm-hmm. But I haven't watched the Simpsons regularly in years, but I always felt like at least at its heyday that the Simpsons did a good job of kind of earning its jokes. And that the show, like, I don't want to start ripping on the Family Guy, but the Family Guy was the show that that would just say, hey, here's a reference, get it. And then that would be it.
Right. Yeah, I feel the same way that you do about the Family Guy. And I'm in a similar boat with you with the Simpsons. I can't remember the last time I watched a new Simpsons on TV or even an old mm-hmm. Simpsons. I used to watch it avidly back in the 90s. And then I guess the early 2000s, it was not infrequent that around dinner time, our family would watch the mm-hmm. new episode of The Simpsons. Just got out of that habit a few years ago, which brings me to another issue. And back to your point of some of these references being kind of quick and almost throwaway. Who's the reader? Who's the intended audience, or who's the audience for these comics, the Simpsons comics, right?
Right.
It seems to me very different assumptions with a comic than with a TV show, because, I mean, I'd be interested in knowing the age range of the actual readers of the Simpson comics, because a lot of these references are going to just go by them. I mean, they can still laugh, they can still enjoy the comic without getting all of that stuff. And maybe that's one of the reasons why a lot of these references are more drive-by than anything, right? Because they feel that mm-hmm. their primary reader wouldn't get it, so why stick on it like the TV show would?
Right.
Yeah. But so that would be an occasion where the strength of the TV show The Simpsons may not work in the favor of The Simpsons comic book, this mm-hmm. in this case being the Treehouse of Horror number 22. I think that's another reason why I appreciate SpongeBob comics more than Simpsons. In Adventure Time, you know, you had mentioned not being as familiar with the characters in this spooktacular issue. I feel the same way. For some reason, I mean, I knew of these characters of Gunter and the Ice King.
Mm-hmm.
But this time around, this year's issue of Adventure Time Spooktacular just didn't do it for me. I mean, I thought it was okay, and for fans of Adventure Time, I'm sure it'll be great to get more Adventure Time Spooktacular. But I didn't enjoy it as much as I enjoyed the Adventure Time Spooktacular issues in past years.
Yeah, you know, my main thing was that I knew the Ice King, and I know many of the major characters in Adventure Time from watching the show sporadically. Wasn't really familiar with Gunter, the Penguin, who doesn't talk, but who seems to be pretty menacing. Right. But the middle, I guess this maybe the second story, Tummy Trouble, written by Travis Betts and drawn by Ruth Turner, I thought was a really clever and pretty dark story when Gunter builds a gun that can basically turn sentient creatures into clothing for him.
Oh yeah.
And so even though he ends up being the hero of the story, he uses that gun in some pretty insidious ways. So I thought that at least the Adventure Time stories had a little more of an edge to them than the others did. They weren't completely playing it safe, and there was places where I really actually laughed out loud while reading this Adventure Time book. So,
I think that middle story that you had mentioned, Tummy Trouble. Yes. I guess that's my favorite of them, but again, there's just something about the character of Gunter that maybe I just don't know enough about. I mean, is he slightly sinister in the television cartoon?
Yeah, I don't know, but I mean, I think maybe there may be not much more to it, you know, that he is just this quiet and cute creature that is actually very often up to no good. So when you've done this show before with Gene, these are pretty regular Halloween specials, right? That The Simpsons, SpongeBob, and Adventure Time do annual, if it's not an issue devoted to the issue of the series devoted to Halloween, like the SpongeBob comic or a special. These three properties do regular Halloween shows, right?
Comics. Right. And if we can get access to these issues in time, then we will talk about them on the show. I know we've talked about SpongeBob in the past. We've definitely talked about Adventure Time Spooktacular. I can't remember if we've discussed Treehouse of Horror before. It's just this time around we were able to get the most recent issue in time. So that's right. Good. And we should mention that there are some other Halloween comics or comics coming out right near Halloween that you and I had wanted to discuss, the most prominent of which is the first issue of Eric Powell's Spook House, but that comes out on Wednesday when this show goes up, and we could not get a review copy ahead of time. We attempted. I reached out to Eric Powell because it's an Albatross Funny Books comic, not a Dark Horse comic. Wasn't able to hear back from him, so unfortunately, we couldn't discuss it for this show. But yeah, you're right. The Treehouse of Horror, SpongeBob, and Adventure Time Spooktacular, those are regular things.
Right.
And then I did see that the Disney via IDW had the giant Halloween hex and thought I'd throw that into the mix.
Right.
Man, you know that house up at the end of the road that nobody goes near? Well, let me tell you why they don't. Well, in the haunted house at the top of the hill, the spooks give around to test their skill. That stroke of 12 every night seems such a frightful sight. Stay away when they go.
Well, you want to move on to the next grouping that we're looking at?
Yes.
And we're going to put these two comics together, both number one issues and not anthologies like the other issues we were just discussing. The first one is Betty Boop number one. This comes out from Dynamite, written by Roger Langridge with art by Giselle Lagasse. I guess that's how you pronounce the name. And then issue number one of Spell on Wheels from Dark Horse, written by Kate Leth with art by Megan Levins.
Mm-hmm.
And these were two that I remember both of us had highlighted of being of interest on past preview shows, and we were probably interested in talking about at least one of these, if not both, at some point anyhow. So this leaves us a great opportunity. Now, neither of these are specifically Halloween or Halloween 2016 comics, but there's enough about them to suggest a Halloween-ness. For instance, there are ghosts that are a part of Betty Boop, and with Spell on Wheels, as you may expect from the title, we're dealing with witches or witch-like activity.
Yeah.
Yeah. So which one do you want to look at first?
Well, you know, I think we can talk about the Betty Boop comic fairly easily. You know, the whole first issue is basically the story, this first story, Enter the Lizard.
Mm-hmm.
And Betty Boop's dealing with some ghosts in this. And so the job of this is to also be introducing us to Betty Boop and her cast of characters.
Right.
As well, you know, including Coco the Clown and Bimbo.
Bimbo, right.
Mm-hmm.
And
I don't know what is Bimbo. Is Bimbo a cat?
I guess. Is one of these somewhat ambiguous anthropomorphic creatures.
Right.
I guess it's a cat.
Yeah, and then Betty Boop and Betty Boop's grandpa, Grampy. Who's also a recurring character. So we're getting introduced to this world that Betty Boop functions in, but also that it is a world in which there are some supernatural things that happen.
Right. And so this is something that, and I would call definitely this an all-age comic, and it's something that older readers who know something about the Fleischer Studios can appreciate and enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
But even younger readers who've never heard of Betty Boop, who have no idea what King Features or the Fleischer Studio was all about. You know, Coco, who is this? What are these characters? You know, knowing nothing about it, I think could appreciate this, because in this first issue, I mean, it is a self-contained story, Enter the Lizard, although there's the sense at the end that we may see in subsequent issues of Betty Boop, some of the events and characters in this first issue come back or play out in some way.
Right.
But it's, for all practical purposes, a self-contained story, and people wondering about the relationship between or among Betty Boop and the other characters. It, again, not knowing anything about Betty Boop or Fleischer Studio history, could get a pretty good sense of what's going on in this first issue. I think they do a good job of providing just enough exposition, which is not much that's needed, in order to appreciate the story.
Sure. And so pretty much all the action and the characters center around the Oopadoop Club,
mm-hmm.
where Coco works as a bartender, and
Bimbo's like a jack of all trades, I guess.
Yeah. Fills in for people, I guess, when they're needed. And Betty is a performer and waitress at this club.
Mm-hmm.
As is Scat Skellington, who is a singing skeleton with an all skeleton band.
Right.
And then
who's a Cab Calloway character?
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And in fact, the song he sings is to the tune of Minnie the Moocher. Although they don't indicate that as such.
Yeah, that's right. So I guess that's a little Easter egg, but the Heidi, Heidi, Heidi.
Heidi, 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 Heidi.
Yeah.
Odie, 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 odie. Yeah, that's a giveaway.
That gives it away, yeah. So it's like a Halloween version of Minnie the Moocher about Dangerous Dolly.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the plot involves something going on at Grampy's house where this lizard and his ghosts have kicked Grampy out of his house.
Right.
And Betty's got to help get it back.
But she also has to contend with her responsibilities at work, because she's always very conscious of the fact that she can't lose her job, because it's her income from working at the Oopadoop Club that provides her Grampy with the means to do what he does with his experiments.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that the art by Legasse is good in that when she's got to draw and I'm assuming it's a she, got to draw human figures. They're kind of abstracted enough, but not too cartoony, but that they can also fit in a world with these very, very cartoony characters like Coco, Betty, and Bimbo and Grampy and so on.
Right.
So I think that this first issue does a really good job of world building for this series.
Mm-hmm. Right. And Lagasse's art, I think, really works well in other ways, in that it strikes me as perfect for something coming out of the Fleischer Studios. I mean, this looks like art that could easily fit on the screen. It's very similar to the old Betty Boop that,
right,
you know, we may have grown up watching or seen references to. Also, it just strikes me as the kind of art that works really well with the kind of writing that Roger Langridge does, even right. his own art. In other words, if I didn't know that Langridge was only the writer and not the artist of this, I may look at this at first and think, oh, okay, well, you know, this is a new Langridge title where he's mm-hmm. maybe doing the art himself. I mean, if I didn't look closely, I may think, okay, that makes sense to me. So I think it fits with the tone and also with the subject matter, and it's a really good fit.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I noticed about this is or some of the touches that I come to see as Roger Langridge comics, and this is, and I'm looking at a PDF, and I think you are as well, so we don't have page numbers, but on the PDF, it's page number 15, and this is when Betty is in the taxi on her way to Grampy's, and we get that page of the taxi driving down this yep. winding street. And, you know, this is something almost out of, you know, the family circus, where you see, you know, the kids running in a little track around the house or around the neighborhood, and you get to see where they are. Something very similar going on here. I saw almost the exact same layout in the first issue of the Baker Street Peculiars, which our friend Andy Hirsch illustrated. This is when the Peculiars were being chased by the police toward the beginning of that first issue. And so there was something going on very similar. So apparently this is indulgence of language where he does things like this. And I think it works really well here as it did with Baker Street Peculiars.
Yep.
So it's a nice little touch. I also think that Lagasse does a good job of not only creating a cartoon Betty Boop, but also retaining, you know, without pushing things, of course, the sexuality of Betty Boop. Because, you know, this was a cartoon character who did have quite a bit of sex appeal to her, but it wasn't threatening in any way, because Betty Boop herself was so cartoony, especially her head shape and her face. And Lagasse does a great job of retaining that delicate balance.
Yep.
So I really like this. I don't know. I definitely wanted to, whether it be for the Halloween show or otherwise, definitely wanted us to take a look at the first issue of Betty Boop. I don't know if I'm going to go on to continue reading Betty Boop. I might, but it mm-hmm. definitely has my attention.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what are your thoughts on Spell on Wheels?
I really liked Spell on Wheels. One of the things that we had talked about when this came up in the previews episodes where we saw it first solicited was that I really liked the kind of high concept that this series was setting up, that you've got these three young female witches who are who've been robbed and they're going about getting their stuff back.
Mm-hmm.
And that is basically what the miniseries, this 5-issue miniseries is going to hinge on, their quest to get their stuff back. But meanwhile, there is a person, you know, the person who robbed them has a history with them of sorts, but he is also working for somebody who we don't get to see.
Right.
So there's that mystery as well. And so I think that while this book isn't necessarily doing anything incredibly groundbreaking, it does it does have enough hooks on it that I think makes it a series that's worth following through the five issues.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this strikes me from this first issue that the miniseries is going to be fun, mm-hmm. right? As you put it, nothing groundbreaking. But then if it only lasts for this first five issues and that's it, then great. If it's successful enough to where the creators decide to go on with another narrative arc, then hey, all the better. And we do have three characters that seem to work really well here. There's Jolene, Claire, and Andy, and each mm-hmm. of them have particular abilities. Now, I think both of us have referenced them as some kind of witch. I guess they're witch-like, although they're never called witches, but they do have certain abilities. So, for instance, Jolene, who is 27, and by the way, they do provide identity boxes the first time each of these characters are introduced to give you the basics. So Jolene is 26. Her abilities are technopathic and emotional manipulation. Claire is 26. Her abilities are psychic, intuition, visions, and reading the cards. And then Andy's the youngest. She's 23, and her abilities are mastery in spells, charms, and potions.
Mm-hmm. I should say, though, that when we're first introduced to them, they are working in a booth called Sister Witches.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, so even though I just said they're not referred to as witches, I didn't even think about that sign on their booth.
Yeah, that's okay. But, and I like that I really like Megan Levins's art on this. And she draws each of the characters, you know, each of the characters is distinct and clear. The difference between them, not just in, in a variety of ways, but also that her art style is really engaging. And again, kind of much like what I was saying with the story itself, really solid storytelling as well. So it's, it's just a good comic narrative. Mm-hmm. And so, I appreciate it. I appreciate it just kind of on that level, which, you know, is something worth praising it for.
Yeah. And, we'd mentioned that this is a Dark Horse comic, and I think Dark Horse does a good job with these kind of stories. Now, you can say that Image does as well, but I think Image normally does this on a regular basis. But I think that when Dark Horse tends to do these miniseries, for instance, like Resident Alien or, let's say, like Lady Killer, they tend to come back for one or more additional narrative arcs. That's one of the reasons why I think that this, if it's successful, I would definitely not be surprised to see this continue on, because just the very premise, right? You have these three young women who have witch abilities, or witches in some way, could go on to other adventures, and the dynamics of their relationship, because there is a difference that is established among all three. And we're just scratching the surface in this first issue in seeing the differences among them. So, for instance, we know that Jolene has some involvement with the guy that broke into their house. We don't know exactly what that was, but that also tells us something different, that she's different in some way from the others. Mm-hmm. Again, we don't get much detail yet, but there's enough hint that these characters are distinct each from the other that this story could easily pan out beyond the first five issues of this mini comic.
Yep.
Or this mini series.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like to definitely go back and, if I didn't know, I may or may not continue to read Betty Boop, and I probably will. I definitely want to continue reading Spell on Wheels.
Who's there? Who's there? Up there on the stair. Beware, beware. I hear somebody coming up on his toe. Oh, look, there he goes. Why, Mr. Ghost is going to town. he takes his cane, his gloves and his hat, and like a cat, he hurries down the alley. The moon is bright, and this is the night when Mr. Gold...
Okay, let's look at the next batch we have on our plate today. And these are both Vertigo titles. The Lost Boys, number one, written by Tim Seeley with art by Scott Godlewski. And then American Vampire Anthology, number two, you know, obviously by Schneider, and a variety of other people are involved in this.
Right.
So, now, you know, we had the first anthology of American Vampire come out, what was it, maybe 3 years ago?
Yeah, I guess.
It's been a while. But we have had something like this before, but we haven't had anything like Lost Boys, or at least... not anything exactly, although it strikes me that this is not that different in some ways from Mad Max, again, which Vertigo did, picking up where the films left off. We have this first issue of Lost Boys picking up where the 1980s film Lost Boys left off.
Right, and so this first issue takes place in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right, so we're coming out of that with many of the same characters returning, but with, I guess, a new kind of vampire involved. It's been a very, very long time since I've seen Lost Boys, and it was never, and I think I mentioned this too when we were talking about the solicit for this in previews, that I was, I think, a little... like kind of older than the fans of Lost Boys were when that movie came out. So I know it was really, really popular with a lot of people, and it just never kind of hit me.
Mm-hmm.
The same that it was hitting them. So I think in a lot of ways, what Seeley and Godlewski are doing in this book is clearly aimed at those fans of the movie. So, you know, those who are familiar with the movie are going to kind of recognize the characters and recognize some references to the movie. But it's also setting up a new status quo, which is that after having, wiped out the vampires, in Santa Carla from the movie, this new vampire, this new kind of species of vampire, I guess, which puts it in play with American Vampire as well, which deals with vampire species, is coming to town, and they're much seem to be much more dangerous and at least much more surprisingly different than the vampires that had been in the movie. So I thought there was some fun stuff in here that, you know, and in fact, a couple of cases where I laughed out loud. But I did feel like one might need to have the movie maybe a little more familiarly in mind when they come to this book than I did.
You know, I both agree and disagree with you. I agree with you in that I'm familiar with the movie, not overly familiar. I've seen it a couple of times, and every now and again when it's on TV, it finds its way of being on our home TV, even if nobody's watching anything, so it's kind of spooky that way. Mm-hmm. So I'm fairly familiar with the story, and so because I'm familiar with the story, I could probably a little too easily say, you know, you may or may not need to know the story to appreciate this comic. I think it helps to have seen the original movie, because it does pick up where it leaves off. We have, you know, the main characters in the film. We have the Emerson brothers, Michael and Sam, although I don't think we've seen their mother yet, Lucy, but we do see their grandfather, who is central to this first issue. And there are also references to other characters that we may not see, at least of yet. Michael's love interest, Star, which is played by, you know, Jamie Gertz in the movie. I don't think she's in here, but definitely the Frog brothers are there, Edgar and then Alan. So they make an appearance. So I think it's useful to have seen the movie when when you pick up this first issue, but I don't think it's absolutely necessary. And for this reason, I think that Seeley does a really good job of writing that kind of past exposition, you know, what happened in the film, into this first issue. And we get this on the first few pages, where apparently Sam Emerson now is working in a comic shop. Did he work in a comic shop in the film? I don't think he did.
No, you got me
just,
there.
I think they had just moved to Santa Carla. But now he's working in a comic shop, and the voiceover we get that begins the first several panels is Sam, we realize, talking with a guy in a comic shop, and he's trying to get this guy to buy issue number one of The Reign of Frogs, which apparently stars the Frog Brothers. And the way that Sam is explaining this comic is, in essence, what happens in the film, The Lost Boys.
Uh-huh.
So if you haven't seen the film, I don't think that would be a deal breaker. I still think that someone without any experience with the movie can appreciate and get everything they need to out of this first issue. It's just that a knowledge of the movie would help.
Mm-hmm. I think where my obstacle came in is in kind of caring about the characters that are returning from the movie. You know, like I think, for example, this issue requires you to, care a lot about the grandfather.
Right.
For example. And so if one doesn't already have an investment in these characters from the movie, that may not work as well for them. And now the brothers, now I'm confused about the brothers. Are there two different sets of brothers?
There are two brothers. They're the Emerson brothers, and they're the main focus of the film, right? So
right.
There's Emerson, who in the movie was turned into a vampire, and then his brother Sam, played by Corey Haim, mm-hmm. You know, God rest his soul, I guess, that, you know, they're the main brothers. But then the other brothers, the Frog Brothers, where, mm-hmm. you know, Corey Feldman, the other Corey in this movie, played Edgar, they're other brothers, and they're more like comedic than otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay, so they're the Frog Brothers and the Emerson Brothers, and
right.
they're separate brothers.
Right, exactly.
Okay, that confused me a bit.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, earlier I said that Star probably doesn't make an appearance, but she does, although it's brief. It's only for about a page and a half that we see her.
Right.
And then we also get to see Laddie, the little kid in the movie who was also temporarily turned into a vampire. Mm-hmm. But I'm right with you there on the grandfather, and knowing the role that he played in the film would make a big difference in the emotional investment you put into this first issue and what seems to happen to him.
Mm-hmm.
Without giving away any spoilers.
Right.
Yeah. And I thought that I have to tell you, I had my doubts. My thoughts, you know, I mentioned earlier that remakes, I'm not a big fan of remakes in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in comics as well, when comic properties revisit an older property, especially if it's something, let's say, from the 80s, it's like, okay, why do it? Just come up with a whole new story or just do something different. Mm-hmm. I had my doubts about this, but after I read the first issue of Lost Boys, I had a better feeling for it and what it is trying to do here. So I'm probably going to continue on with this. Now, how many issues, have they announced how many issues this is going to be?
No, I think it's an ongoing.
So it's going to be an ongoing for the foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's interesting. I might have to go back and watch the movie again to see how I feel about it. See if my feelings have changed about it. But, I don't know if I'm gonna get beyond this first issue, in my own reading of it. I guess I'll wait to see and maybe again revisit the movie. But I think that we're probably heading towards. I mean, we're already there in a lot of ways. That there's I feel like there's a whole world of nostalgia out there right now for stuff that passed me by, you know, that I was in college and wasn't, you know, paying attention to it, or was aimed at a younger audience than I was, or whatever. But that that came out kind of in that mid to late 80s, early 90s period. And this is, you know, in movies, music, television, a whole ton of stuff that I know people feel a real strong connection to that I have almost no knowledge of or connection to. And I think Lost Boys really does fall under that banner for me.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm not going to begrudge kids who are into that.
Well, I mean, that's interesting. You say kids who are into that. I mean, I'm wondering what the demographic for this comic is going to be. If the readers of Lost Boys are going to be those like us who are familiar and who maybe have grown up in or around that time period, or maybe trend younger. I have no way of knowing.
Yeah, I don't even remember I probably should have looked this up, what the year of the movie is.
1987.
1987, yeah. Okay, so I was just graduating high school then. Mm. Or had probably just graduated when that came out. And so I probably should have been in my wheelhouse, but wasn't.
So what's wrong with you?
Yeah, I don't know. there's a lot of things that I just, you know, I guess I just didn't get. I get into. I could go down a list.
Yeah.
of you know, music that I missed and TV shows that I missed. I feel like, for example, I have almost no connection to Family Matters at all, and I know some people my age and younger just love Urkel.
You know, I'm the same way. I never watched an episode. I may have seen it in passing channels, but other than that, I've never watched an episode of Family Matters all the way through. Although I do remember quite a number of times in the past making Urkel references.
Okay.
Now, the other Vertigo title that is, I guess, Halloween horror-rich is American Vampire Anthology number 2. And, Andy, you and I were talking before we started recording today about our experiences with American Vampire. I have to tell you, or as I mentioned to you, it's been a long time since I kept up with American Vampire. And I keep meaning to catch up, but I haven't for the longest time. And so I was hoping that maybe you were much more caught up on American Vampire than I was, to where you can help me understand American Vampire Anthology number 2. But then I learned, right before we started recording, that you're really behind on your American Vampire reading as well.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't even started the second cycle. So right. I read all the way through and kept up mainly in trades with the first cycle, and then along with those, the first anthology and some of the other one shots that were done. But I haven't been reading the American Vampire then in a while. And so, so the framing sequence of this issue takes place in 1967. And while it features some, you know, some stuff I'm familiar with, I guess, some characters I'm familiar with and some references, I found myself to be really almost kind of completely lost, to the point that I kind of stopped reading it after the opening framing sequence. So I'm a bad reviewer here in that I didn't read this book.
Well, I feel like an inadequate reviewer because I read it through, but again, a lot of this stuff I lost. Now, I didn't even read the first American Vampire anthology from a few years ago. I mean, I'm even more behind in my American Vampire reading. I don't think I got through that first cycle all the way through. Again, mm-hmm. This is something I've been meeting because I love the title. I just stopped reading it for different reasons and intended to go back and never did. So being so many years away from American Vampire, and we should mention that for those who don't know American Vampire, it's not like this has continuously been published. I mean, it's gone on hiatuses quite a number of times, for various reasons. In fact, it's announced at the very end of this issue of the anthology number 2 that American Vampire will return in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as if the publication schedule encourages readers to keep up with it. But again, for whatever reasons, I didn't keep up with it, and I felt that that made me unable to understand what was going on. So there were some references, some characters, some situations I remembered as I read them,
mm-hmm.
but the vast majority of the situations in anthology number 2 went over my head. Although the story seemed good, whether or not I could understand them was something else entirely. And the art I really enjoyed as well, because, I mean, we did have, okay, some of these stories, the opening and the closing story, you know, the frame, as you mentioned, those were written by Scott Snyder, you know, the original writer. But then other writers in this anthology, the story Tea House was written by Joelle Jones, not the art by Joelle Jones, which we usually know her by, but the writing. Marguerite Bennett did Bride. Clay McLeod Chapman did The Bleeding Nun, which was rather creepy. Steve Orlando did The Cut. Elliot Kalan did Traveling Companion. Sean Aldridge, When the Cold Wind Blows. Kieran Gillen, England's Dreaming. Raphael Albuquerque, the penultimate story, Devil's Own Luck. And then we have different artists for each of these stories as well. So I think it's in terms of the comics that we're looking at this week that are an anthology, right, have a variety of different stories, different creators, different writers and artists. This has the most star power than the others that we're discussing. I just wish I could have appreciated more fully what they're doing.
Sure. You know, and in the last the first anthology that they did was also there to bridge a publishing gap within the series.
Right, between the first and second cycle?
I don't know if it was between the first and second cycle or within the first cycle, but it was in there, yeah.
Okay.
Because they had the other one shot that Raphael Albuquerque wrote. Now I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but that was in one of those breaks as well. So so they have a history of doing that with the series, which I think is a good idea, especially for keeping those readers who are reading it from month to month. But since I'm reading in the trades, and even still then, still far behind with the trades. I'm going to hold off on reading this until I've gotten caught up.
Okay. Was this the one with Albuquerque? Is that the Long Road to Hell? Was that?
Yes. Okay. Yes, that's it.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting in that American Vampire has a really deep history. Mm-hmm. It's just, I think it's easy for us, for readers, to forget about American Vampire, especially as a Vertigo title, just because it's not out frequently. Didn't used to be that way, though.
Right.
Because I remember this came out originally around the time of iZombie, because I remember getting into both of those and reading them avidly at around the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and it started – the first issue was 2010. I just looked it up.
Okay.
Wow. It's – for some reason, I thought it was longer ago than that. I guess not.
I don't know how many total issues there have been now either.
Let me see. There were 34 in the first cycle, and so far, I guess we have 11 in the second. So when it returns, and that's not counting those miniseries like Lord of Nightmares, Survival of the Fittest, and the anthologies, but... Mm. When it returns next year, is this going to be part of the second cycle?
I don't know. I'm assuming.
Wow. Okay.
I don't know.
In the my eyes turn blue. I got long hair growing on my fingers too. I'm the wolf man. I'm the wolf man, baby. And if you see me on the prowl, watch it when you hear me growl.
Well, let's look at the last couple of titles that we're going to be discussing for our Halloween episode. This is The Double Life of Miranda Turner, and this is published in hard copy from Image, although it was originally a Monkey Brain digital comic, written by Jamie Rich with art by George Kambadais. And that's Kambadais, and so I may be butchering that last name. And then Nick's Comics Quarterly number 9 by our friend Ken Epstein and others, but he's the main writer of this. And in fact, I say by Ken Epstein and others because Ken is the one who has kept us informed of Nick's Comics. He contacted us, I think it was last year originally, to let us know about Nick's Comics, and we appreciate him keeping us in the loop. Now, in terms of The Double Life of Miranda Turner, I didn't know about this until I saw it solicited through Image. Did you know about this as a Monkey Brain digital comic?
I had heard of it, but I hadn't read it.
Okay. And it struck me when I realized that it was a Monkey Brain title, at least in digital form, I was reminded of the fact that it's been a long time since I've kept up with what Monkey Brain's doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's stuff going on there.
Yeah.
So,
but because, I wasn't aware of this title at all.
Yeah, because several things that have been Monkey Brain titles are now coming through Comixology Submit, as far as I can tell.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like the Boo Anthology, which is one I wanted to talk about, but doesn't come out till the 26th.
Oh, that's right.
Is normally a Monkey Brain anthology, and so now it's just straight from Comixology.
Yeah, that's another title that you and I had thought that we would want to discuss, but it's just not out yet. So The Double Life of Miranda Turner collects the 9 issues that was originally out through Comixology between October of 2013 and April of this year. This story, I guess it's okay. Again, I wasn't familiar with it before this Image book. And this first volume is called If You Have Ghosts. And it more or less sets up the premise of everything to follow. And so what you have, I guess the title character, Miranda Turner, is an actress who takes on the mantle of the cat. And we find out fairly early on in this book that this is a role that had been assumed by Miranda's sister, Lindy. But she had been a model or an actress, and then she also was this heroic character called the Cat. But then she was killed, and then upon being killed, she turned into a ghost. And so this is where this title comes into our Halloween series, because as Miranda is fighting crime and doing the kind of things that she does, then it's her sister's ghost that accompanies her and helps her through things. And so we have so the double life of Miranda is actually a couple things. You know, the fact that she plays a superhero, or at least a crime fighter, a costume crime fighter. But she has an ordinary life as an actress. But the doubleness of her life is also the fact that her sister Lindy's ghost, who was also a costume crime fighter, follows Miranda around and helps her solve crimes. Now, I mentioned the backstory with Lindy Turner. Curiously enough, we don't get much, if any, information about Lindy and what happened to her until issue number 4, what had originally been issue 4 of the digital comic, or I guess you can call it chapter 4 here in the book. And I felt at a little disadvantage in understanding this story because the exposition seemed to come in full about a third of the way into this book. I think I could have understood more of what was going on if I'd gotten a little more background information within this first chapter or the first issue, because we're kind of just thrown into this story where Miranda and Lindy, her ghost, they're fighting a couple of guys called the Blockheads. And these are a pair, I guess they may be brothers, and their weapon of choice are like Legos, little blocks. Thus, they're named the Blockheads. And so visually, this is fun. It's very colorful. But the first couple of chapters of this book, I felt lost. And it's interesting. I may want to go on to read more of The Double Life of Miranda Turner. I don't know. But I'm assuming there are plans for more Miranda Turner issues because this is called Volume 1. But I think something that we're probably more familiar and comfortable with is Nix Comics Quarterly number 9.
Yes.
And in fact, both of us have seen Ken just recently. I at SPX and you at CXC.
Yeah. I got a chance to talk with Ken a number of times. And one of the things that I really like that Ken does, and I got to pick up some more of these, is that he, you know, he buys old 45s and then draws new sleeves for those. And so he has a box full of these records and I go through them and pick out some. They also make great gifts. So I really like the work that Ken does at Nick's Comics in general and the stuff that he sells at cons. And and then I've been following him, I guess, at least for a few years. But yeah, he's a kind of staple of the Columbus comic scene.
Mm-hmm. And music scene.
Yes.
Because he's a musician as well. And in fact, when he and I hung out for a while on Sunday morning at SPX, we had breakfast. He said they had a good breakfast at Whole Foods. So I said, okay, I'll go. Yep. And so we walked over there and had breakfast together. And I think we ended up talking at least as much, if not more, about music than we did comics.
Mm-hmm.
But for those who want a sense of what Nix Comics Quarterly is all about, and not just this issue number 9 that we're discussing today, comics and music, I think, would be a good way of encapsulating Nix Comics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this issue has a couple stories that I really loved. One being the very, very first story, Verna's Somnambulant Adventure.
Right.
Written by Ken and drawn by Gideon Kendall. And Gideon Kendall's art is reminiscent of kind of got a Jack Davis feel to it.
I thought the exact same thing. Yes.
Yeah. Which is really great for this story. And basically, Verna's, roommate Sally collects Beatles memorabilia, and she has now finally gotten these rare Haitian bootleg Beatles dolls, which look horrible. And of course, in the tradition of great horror anthology stories, the dolls turn out to be demonic. And so Verna ends up running into some problems with these dolls. And I think this is not only is a fun story that is a variation on the devil doll, type of story, but also, Ken is really doing a good job of making fun of kind of collectors and completists and the horrors of being a completist and not having everything.
Right.
So I thought this did a good job of parodying that kind of collector mentality while also being a genuinely good horror story.
Yeah, it is. I mean, everything you said, I agree with totally. I like all the stories in this issue of Nix Comics Quarterly, but I have to say that this first story is by far my favorite. One, because it plays into the, you know, the devil doll narrative line that we have a variety of different variations of. So I think this is a great variation of that, right? That you have these bootleg beetle dolls from Haiti, and they become the devil dolls. I also like what they do in terms of the collector mentality. And for instance, at the very end of the story, and this is not a spoiler by any means, we see scrolled in blood on the wall on the final panel a message to, Vernie's roommate, Sally. Why haven't you bought the new box set yet, Sally? You know, so there's the comment of the collector's mentality and the completist. But the thing I appreciate even more about this comic, and especially that last comic, is the great reference to the infamous Butcher cover that was never used of Yesterday and Today.
Right.
I mean, to me, that is the genius touch of this strip.
Yeah. So this strip brings in all that, brings in, you know, Beatles references, collectors, and is still manages to throw in at the end a solid EC horror twist to the story. So I think Ken and Gideon really knocked that story out.
Right. And, you know, there's this similar nice EC-ish balance between horror and humor in other stories as well. Yeah. Another one I really enjoyed was the Shoplift Horror, and this is written by Christian Hoffer with art by Andy Bennett. Mm-hmm. And basically you have, this shadowy hooded figure comes into a record shop and he asks for 8-tracks. He says, do you have any 8-tracks? And in fact, the lettering in his word bubbles, this hooded figure, you know, does have this kind of, you know, older 8-track-ish feel to it, right? The way that those letters are drawn. Mm-hmm. And apparently he's using the search for 8-tracks as an excuse to steal something. He's wanted to shoplift, and he says at one point that he's looking for a specific Bee Gees 8-track. And the punchline at the end, after this shadowy hooded figure is caught trying to steal, the shop owner sweeping up and says, well, that was probably the first time someone has died over the Bee Gees.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. The other story I really liked in this issue was the final story, "Hellhounds on My Trail," written by Ken with art by Pat Redding Scanlon, which stars a character named Anna Tatsura, which is an anagram, I guess, for Tura Satana, the famous actress who starred in Russ Meyer's Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, and who looks like this character as well. But basically she's on the road hitchhiking with her guitar in her suitcase, and she gets picked up by what I guess is a werewolf, and she takes care of the werewolf. And that's it. I mean, it's a short 3-page story, but it really looks cool, and it's got a fun feel to it as well.
Yeah. In fact, this entire first issue, this entire issue number 9, even when not dealing with horror like stories, is fun. I mean, the very last piece, I think it was the very last piece. Yeah, Did It Really Happen? Stan Lee meets Thor, the Rock Warrior. This comic, you know, mostly written by Ken, just has a fun, humorous, clever feel to it.
Yep.
And it's something we highly recommend you check out. In fact, just about 2 days ago, I got my hard copy of this issue, Nick's Comics Quarterly number 9, because I backed it on Kickstarter.
Yes.
So thank you for sending it in a timely manner, Ken.
Yep, thank you.
Yeah, can't wait for issue number 10.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Andy, we had a big agenda for this week. We looked at quite a number of Halloween and Halloween kinds of comics. Among the titles we looked at was The Simpsons Treehouse of Horror number 22, SpongeBob Comics number 61, Adventure Time Spooktacular 2016, Disney's Giant Halloween Hex, Betty Boop number 1, Spell on Wheels number 1, The Lost Boys number 1, American Vampire Anthology number 2, The Double Life of Miranda Turner, and Nick's Comics Quarterly number 9.
Yep. Yeah, that's a full plate.
That's right. More than we usually discuss, but every now and again, we try to rise to the challenge. And if you want to rise to challenges, then you would do well to visit the website of our sponsor, which is Discount Comic Book Service. Go to dcbservice.com, and there you're going to find specials that challenge your sanity. I mean, you'll look at it and you'll go, I can't believe this. I must be seeing things. I'm going crazy. There can't be comics this low. But yes, our friends, you will find great, great discounts at dcbservice.com. And after you do get your comics there, get in touch with us and let us know what kind of things you're going to be reading. If you go to the website comicsalternative.com, you'll find that you can leave us a voice message through SpeakPipe, or you can call us over the telephone. Our phone number is 415-3-COMICS. That's 415-326-6427.
That's right. Or you could get a hold of us by email. We are twoguys@comicsalternative.com. And you can also get a hold of us individually. I'm Andy@comicsalternative.com.
And I'm Derek@comicsalternative.com.
And in addition, we have our Twitter feed, which is @2GuysWithPhDs.
That's right. You can also find us on Facebook, Tumblr, Instagram, Google+, Goodreads, Pinterest, and YouTube. You can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. You can stream us on Stitcher. You can also find us on TuneIn, on Spotify, and on iHeartRadio. And if you're an Android user, on Google Play Music. But you can find every single one of our podcast episodes, as well as the reviews and the comics-related commentary that we post on our blog, simply by going to our website, comicsalternative.com.
That's right. All the ways to get a hold of us and let us know how we're doing.
That's right. And we do like to hear from you. And we will be back next week to look at the November previews catalog. But until then, I'm Derek.
And I'm Andy. See ya.